Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
50-50 football, the Thursday edition. We've had a Thursday, we've had a Monday. Do be telling your friends about it. 50-50 football going all over the place this weekend. It's a strange weekend ahead. We're going to be speaking to Natasha Henry about Arsenal, Dan Hewitt about West Bromwich Albion. We've got Andy Middleton to talk to us about West Ham, and Gary from the Stacey West blog to talk about Lincoln City. They're all going to join us in the studio. I've got Rob Gutman and Mo Stewart to talk about, well, pretty much everything as it comes up one after the other. But the sixth round of the Cup weekend, Rob, it's sort of partially marked on my sort of childhood as the weekend where everything all goes a bit mad because of the number of games that get cancelled. You know, it's got a huge knock-on effect for the league programme on the one hand. On the other hand, obviously, they're all big games. It's the quarter-final of the FA Cup, for God's sake, so, you know, it's a big, big deal. It's a funny weekend, really, where every game can grab you, but you can feel as though it just sort of scoots over you in the blink of an eye.
Yes, it's decision time quietly, I think, for fans and clubs. It's sort of choose your weapons. Do you want league placing? Do you want cup run? It's the time at which some of your rivals get games in hand ahead of you. So you start to imagine scenarios.
Points on the board.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's the time of year where I end up doing maths. And it just gets very, very complicated. I'm a Liverpool supporter, and already I'm thinking, great, Man U and Arsenal aren't playing this weekend. We can get 3 points out of them, and psychologically that's a big deal. But then again, there's the likes of United who are facing the Cup weekend, and they're going, quarterfinals, nearly a semi-final, we've won something already, who knows? Is this the weekend that we realise this is our priority?
This is the funny thing about it, Mo, is that it does begin to make those sorts of decisions for players, for teams, for everyone all comes together, really, and begins to have a good sort of think about the way in which it scatters the fixture list. And it can, I remember going back, I think it's about 07, there's an Arsenal-Man United game, and Arsenal at the top of the table at the time, and United batter them. They make a show with them.
Yep,
and Arsenal's season just falls off a cliff from that point, and that includes the league form. Mm-hmm. And you can say, well, they're different tournaments, but it didn't seem like that. Arsenal just go from you thinking to themselves, you know what, they could win the league again this year. And I think in the end, they finish third and they win nothing.
Mm-hmm. That's happened a couple of times to Arsenal, I think. I think it was 2003, the year that they crumbled against United, the similar thing happened. But I'm like you, quarterfinal day is one of my childhood favourite days. I think it's mainly because match of the day seemed to last forever because there was loads of league games, and it was the only time where you got league games and FA Cup games on match of the day at the same time, and it was massive. So I think this part of the weekend, this part of the calendar, sorry, is the last time where people can, like you say, they make their mind up about where they want to be and what they want to do.
Yep, and that becomes the big thing. And also the magic of the Cup, Mo, and I'll go back to you on this. You know, the involvement of the top of there's five of the top six sides in the last eight. And this is where, you know, when all the stuff comes out around third and fourth round weekend, maybe we should give a Champions League place over to the FA Cup and all this sort of stuff, and the top sides don't take it seriously enough, etc., etc. Well, this is five of the top six. Liverpool got knocked out by Wolves in a game that they would have expected to get a win from, but Wolves turned up on the day. Chelsea beat them in the next round. There's a thing here, isn't there? This is football. Well, if five of the top six are in the last eight, then that's an FA Cup.
If you're going to be slightly glib about it, you could say that some of the reason why the top sides get stick for disrespecting the cup, I mean, if they have disrespected it, it hasn't done them any harm because they're all, like you say, they're all in the final quarterfinal stage. So it's almost as if they know that they can still get there regardless of what they do earlier on, unless they do something really stupid like we did.
Indeed. no escaping that sort of thing. We'll start off with the Premier League. We're a Premier League show, Rob. That's what we've decided.
Yeah.
The Cup's coming this weekend. We'll start off with the Premier League. West Brom. We're going to talk to Dan Hewitt in a minute about West Brom, but there is a question mark around. They've attacked a bit more than a Tony Pulis side normally does this season. They've played all right in patches. They've got some good wins under the belt. They've gone on a neat little run before being stopped against Crystal Palace last weekend, but it was noticeable the Crystal Palace defeat comes at the moment when they break the 40-point barrier and suddenly Crystal Palace turn up and they get themselves all 3 points.
Yes, yeah. I think at some point the sound bounce was going to kick in.
Mm. So do you see this as a Palace win rather than a West Brom knocking off?
I do. The strange thing about West Brom and Pulis is Pulis sort of mastered this down the years. Now, I feel he's done it exceptionally well again this season. Is when other teams aren't looking, he'll take the points off them. Mm. It's almost it is when a team rock. I mean, I've sat there from a Liverpool point of view and gone, okay, they've been playing well, they've been picking up points. Man United or City have rolled into the Hawthorns. Maybe they'll get a point off them. No. You know, it's never about West Brom. That's almost, it feels like it's never about West Brom. That game was about Palace and Palace's need for points. And Palace were at home then, weren't they? Yeah, they were. So they were going to get that result. West Brom's, Pulis's art has been almost to sort of pick up those points where nobody's sure of their motivation, and he'll quietly be compact. His team will be contained. And they'll be set up to not lose a football match and nick it if it's there to be won.
And that's what I think is so interesting about this weekend, because it is a big game. I mean, it feels a little bit like the European playoff final. Like, if West Brom lose this game, then that's it. Pretty much the top seven. And how they approach that is going to be really interesting, because as an away side, normally they'll sit back, try and contain. But I suspect with the looking to Everton have the pressure on them, they might try and come up with something a little bit different.
Let's find out what Dan Hewitt thinks about West Brom, both last weekend and in general. This is what he had to say. Delighted to be joined by Dan Hewitt to talk about West Bromwich Albion. And we had a chat, Dan, you and I, a couple of weeks back, and we said, you know, this West Brom side, this Tony Pulis side, has got to kick on. It's got to do the next thing in the football match, in the football season, and build itself. And, you know, we'll see, and a surge towards seventh. And then they got beaten home by Crystal Palace.
Yeah, a bit of a missed opportunity, especially with Everton losing at Tottenham. I mean, we go into the game on Saturday, it could have been just 1 point between us. Now it's four, so even if we do win on Saturday, obviously we've still got a lot of work to do to catch them. I did say to you, I think, in the podcast a couple of weeks ago as well, that we're into that stage of the season now where you're playing teams that we beat Palace away 1-0 at the start of the season. They have a lot more to play for now because they're kind of fighting for their lives. So the teams we've been kind of beating quite comfortably below us, I think we're facing very different sides now with much, much more to play for. And Palace were much better than us on Saturday. We never really got going. As you said, it's a test, isn't it?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is the never really got going part. I mean, it's not something you can level at this West Brom side very often this season, the idea that they've never really got going, and yet, and that'd be sort of the concern. And this is, you know, it's what the energy's been poured into. Is the energy being poured into 40 points, lads, and then go from there? Or is the energy poured into finish as high up the table as possible?
Maybe a bit of both, I think, probably. I also think, and I don't think many Albion fans, to be honest, took the defeat on Saturday that seriously, because we have been on such an amazing run. I think there's an acceptance that we are going to lose games. You can't win them all and keep picking up points all of the time. There are going to be games where you do get setbacks. And I think, actually, if I'm being honest, Crystal Palace, you look at their team and some of their players, they really shouldn't be where they are. I think that it's a pretty good Crystal Palace side. Some of the players, Kabay and Andres Townsend and Zaha and Benteke, Hennessy and Golliff, they've got some good players that shouldn't really be there. I think you're right. The test comes now is when you've got yourself in a position where we're safe and we've got those 40 points. The question is, have the kind of the players got the ambition and the hunger to kind of push on? I personally think they have. I don't think Saturday's a result we should take that seriously. Crystal Palace massively needed the 3 points. They're a good side with a good manager. I think they will stay up. And we are on an incredibly good run. And when those two kind of factors come together, you do see results like that, where the team who kind of are due a defeat go ahead and lose, and the team that are kind of need to win and are due a victory do eventually win. So I agree with you. I think you're right. There's a test for the players, but I'm not sure Saturday really tells us that much either way, if I'm being honest.
But I think this Saturday does. I mean, it's again in that sort of that way in which you mentally rank teams. We were having conversations with Evertonians prior to their game against Spurs, saying that it was a challenge for both sides, Spurs and Everton. We were going to get a real sense of where both were, and the proof of that particular pudding is the distance between Spurs and Everton is relatively significant. This weekend, it's a story for West Brom, isn't it, in a sense, in terms of, well, what's the gap between West Brom and Everton? Is it what we think it is, i.e. the current, what the points suggest it is, or is there a bit of a gulf between these two sides? And I think that's the telling factor, really, this weekend, isn't it? That's what the test is for West Bromwich Albion.
It is, and I think we've talked about before, haven't we, this idea of, are we top of the bottom league or bottom of the top league? And I think that's, this Saturday is the kind of perfect example of finding out which one it is. Are we doing the best of the rest, or are we legitimately going to be able to compete with Everton, maybe not that far off Liverpool, United obviously slightly above them? How big is that gulf? I think Saturday will tell us a lot. In many ways, and this is, I think, where Tony Pulis has been good as a manager, is when you have a performance like Saturday, where you don't really get going, don't play particularly well, lose relatively comfortably. It's very rare this next game you have a similar performance. It's often you pick yourself up, you dust yourself down, and you say, right, that wasn't good enough, and Saturday's going to be a lot better. And you kind of, in many ways, go back to basics. You become hard to beat again. You run twice as far, and you play twice as well. And I think, for me, in many ways, that going into this game, it's that defeat, hopefully, as the defeat is kind of out of our system. And the shame is, obviously, we could have reduced the gap. We chose a bad week to get beaten, because I think if we'd beat Palace, would have been, say, going into the Everton game, a point behind. I think we probably are top of the bottom league. I think there is a bit of a gulf between us and Everton. And when you've got their manager being linked with Barcelona and Arsenal, and you've got someone like Lukaku up front and some of the players they've got, if you look at the team again, if you look at Everton's team, look at West Brom's team, this is no disrespect to any West Brom players, but how many West Brom players would Everton take and put in their team? We would probably take almost half their team and put them in our team. And that's probably a good way of looking at the two teams. Everton aren't really looking at any West Brom players, and we would probably take half their side. So the gulf is actually quite big. But on any given day, on one game, the way we have been playing, the way Pulis is hard to beat against teams like Everton, we've got a pretty good record against Everton in the last couple of years. So, and I remember us beating them 1-0 last season before, and we beat them 4-1 a few seasons ago. So we can go to Goodison Park and win, but I suspect whatever the result on Saturday, I think Everton are that just a little bit extra ahead of us at the moment, to be honest.
I think one of the things, watching West Brom this season and seeing the results come in, one of the things that struck me is that you could do with a little bit more, if I say consistency in terms of end product from Rondon. I don't think it's consistency in terms of work rate. I don't think there's been a game this season that I've seen West Brom play, even in highlights, where it looked like he's shirking anything. But it's been a while now since he stuck it in the back of the net. When he's got decent enough, tidy numbers this season, but one, I think there's a brace and a hat trick in there. There isn't the idea that he's not this last few weeks been scoring key goals. He's not been, you know, he's, as I say, he's been involved, but he's not been doing the job that, for instance, when you reference Lukaku, that Lukaku's doing. He's not been grabbing the ball, changing the entire outlook of the game for West Brom.
No, it's a really good point, actually. I'm in the process at the moment of writing a blog for ITV on Rondon and what we think of him. And I still haven't worked out whether, after all this time, Rondon is actually any good or not. he's such an odd player. I think he's right. I think work rate, you can't knock him, and he's got fitter. He's definitely lost weight. He looks a little bit more comfortable with the Premier League. But for a guy who scores so many headers inside the sort of 6 to 8 yard sort of area, outside the box, he just does not do enough to hold the ball up. He works hard, but he very, very rarely wins. Wins kind of 50-50s with defenders. He's not particularly great at holding the ball up. He doesn't perform against the top teams. I mean, his goal record, I think, in this season, he scored against Crystal Palace, Stoke, Swansea, got a hat-trick. Against the kind of, we went to Arsenal away on Boxing Day, and you could have put a traffic cone where he was standing, frankly. And Pulis took him off after 55 minutes and put Canu on, which shows just how badly he felt he was playing. Spurs away again, he was just the ball bouncing off him and not holding the ball up enough. And as you say, he's still not prolific. Middlesbrough away again a few weeks ago when we drew 1-1, and he missed two really good chances. I was with my uncle at the Middlesbrough game, and Morrison slipped him through, and he took a bad touch and just shot it wide. And my uncle said he didn't score because he couldn't head it. And that's exactly why. I mean, he seems to be, he's got a reputation as someone who can crack it ahead of the ball. But that's kind of all we've seen from Rondon. We do need to see a bit more. And we know he's got it in him. And we played Leicester away last season. He scored the opener and he knocked off Wes Morgan and ran through and put it in the bottom corner. And he thought, right, finally, we're seeing that side of him. It just hasn't been. I use the word consistent. That's exactly the right word. We just don't see that consistency from Rondon. I'd be surprised in the summer if Pulis is looking for another striker, because we have been relying. I mean, Gareth McCauley is our joint top goal scorer. Now, that's great. But when you're relying on a 37-year-old centre-back to score as many goals as your striker, then you've got kind of alarm bells are ringing. And I think we've almost in many ways kind of broke with convention. Often the rule is if you're number 9 or your number 10 are banging in goals, that'll kind of take you up the table. Well, we've been in our position with our striker not scoring. I mean, Robertson Cano's only scored one. So I think between our two strikers, I've only got sort of 9 or 10 goals, which... You see, we're 8th in the league and we've scored quite a few. We are heavily reliant on Morrison and McCauley and Chadley and Brunt to chip in with goals. That's great, but you can imagine where we would be if we did have that sort of $20 a season.
I was going to say, it doesn't even have to be 20. You know, the idea that if you could get someone who gets you a return of, say, 16 league goals, you know, it isn't to be sniffed at. And that's, you know, that it does seem a clear area for improvement. But it's a shame on the other side because, as I say, whenever I've seen West Brom and you're saying the same thing, it's not as though he's not committed to the cause. And that's where you can end up sort of, you know, it's difficult for a manager there because he can see that he's getting results, that his team's functioning the way in which he wants to function. But on the other hand, there is such a thing as cold, hard numbers. And they do have some sway.
Exactly. And ultimately, he hasn't got any competition. And we sold Berahino in January, so we've got even less. I mean, it is literally Robson, Cano and Rondon. There are two strikers, our two strikers on the books at West Brom. We have two strikers. One was a free and one is Rondon. So it's actually kind of a miracle that we've managed to get to where we are in the season when you look at the stats and look at the facts that when it comes to our kind of our strike force. As I say, I will be surprised if we don't in the summer look to give Rondon, at least give Rondon something to think about in terms of competition. I mean, Shane Long was the kind of striker I really rated at West Brom and felt he was kind of unfairly treated, though he again would disappear in games. And I think the fact that at Southampton he's not really ever had a full run in the team. We've been looking at J. Rodriguez again from Southampton. But for me, I think Rondon is still just not... The question really is, are we looking at a player that he's kind of one season away from reaching his full potential, he just needs time, or are we really seeing, this is it with Rondon, this is what we're going to get? And I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we've seen enough to conclude either way, but my kind of gut instinct, and I think as the more we see him, a lot of West Brom fans' gut instinct is that actually he probably isn't the real deal, and we probably do need to think about replacing him.
One more to talk about quick before I let you go, and before we, chat about the weekend's game, is I want to talk about Livermore. He's come straight in. Again, we were having conversations earlier this season about the reliance on Jakob and Fletcher and the fact that they're coming, at least in Jakob's case, to the end of a career, towards the end of a career. Livermore's been trusted, been given the shirt and been given his run.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably been the best player in almost every game he's played, actually. Jakob, he's quite fortunate because when he came in, it was a bit of a surprise that Pulis was so keen on buying a midfielder because it looked like the one area of our team where we didn't particularly need players. We've got, say, Jakob, Fletcher, Morrison, Chadley. We've got plenty of... We've got a young lad called Fields who's been kind of coming on. He started against Middlesbrough. He's been coming on. He's only 18 off the bench. So it's kind of an odd decision. But then Jakob, fortunately for Livermore, got injured and got ill, I think, a couple of games into his arrival, and went straight in and was man of the match in his first game and has been brilliant. And that's the kind of thing you want to see from a club. Like you said, you want to see the manager looking at the squad and thinking, right, I've got a sort of 31-year-old and a 32-year-old playing centre midfield. I need to be looking at buying someone younger to replace them. Livermore slotted in really well, actually, in a really, really key position. The way West Brom play, that kind of central midfield is so key. And to lose Jakob and not really notice it just shows how well Livermore has done. One of my good friends is a Hull fan, and when we signed him, they said kind of disappointed to see him go. But he's kind of an odd player, and he never really kind of worked out whether he was the real deal when he was at Hull and obviously at Tottenham before that. So far, I think he is. I think he's been fantastic. And him and Fletcher are playing very, very well together. And I think he has a little bit more than Jakob. He's a bit more mobile, and that's kind of, he's younger. So bit more pace, a bit more mobile. But I'm just a huge fan of Claudio Jakob, and if Livermore was to kind of get injured or Fletcher was, Jakob would slot back in, I think, pretty comfortably.
Okay. It's the test of the weekend, as you say, whether or not it's that Everton are the bottom of a league of seven or Everton are top of a league of 13-14 is the question really from the weekend's game. And what are you expecting from West Brom? Is it a game that you feel as though you can get a positive result?
I always think we're going to win, keep the pace and all that. I think because of the Palace result, I think we'll be a bit more tight. I think we'll be tighter. I think we'll be frustrated. I think Pulis will kind of go back to, in many ways, his instincts and make sure, first and foremost, we don't concede early and we play a lot more kind of tight and more a lot more organised than we were against Palace. We allowed the games far too open against Palace and we allowed some really good players to run us. They've got some cracking players. When we beat them 1-0 last season and Rondon scored a header, obviously, of course, he did. We won 1-0 and when we scored early, and that meant they kind of pushed on to us and we like that. We're not averse to letting the other team have the ball and play in front of us in two banks of five. I think if we can get an early goal, then we can frustrate them. They've still got a bit of the kind of Roberto Martinez about them, Everton, and are still quite reluctant to knock the ball forward. So we have to let them play in front of us. I think we can get something. I personally would take a point. But I mean, I suppose we're in the situation now, and as you said, we're not going to get relegated. So in many ways, why not go there and have a go? Because if we lose, well, what have we lost? Eighth place to ninth, potentially, in 2 weeks' time. In reality, that's not going to make much of a difference. So if it's a bit of a test of Pulis, if he does really fancy kind of pushing into seventh, we've got to beat Everton. Our season's pretty much over if we lose on Saturday. So that's a kind of test of Pulis to see whether he can go there and attack.
Get the result that he needed, play more attacking football this season. Brilliant stuff from Dan as ever. Let's get back over and see what everybody else thinks. Dan there from the Everton side, Rob. Very much second best against Spurs. And I think if I say it's chastening, people might feel as though I'm being needly. I'm really not, really. They look like a gulf between the sides, quite a significant one. Everton have been on a good run and they just sort of ran into Spurs. It wasn't as simple as Harry Kane just puts it in the back of the net. That obviously helps. But when Kane scores, Spurs should already be ahead in the game. In the aftermath of Kane scoring, you can quite easily argue that they should get another two before the break rather than just the one. It seemed to me to be a bit of a demolition job that first half.
Yeah, the final score of 3-2 hugely flatters Everton. Spurs murder them. Yeah, it should have been, well, it all but was game over by half time. If you know, from an Everton point of view, I think what would have disappointed me most is if you'd watched, and I did watch both Spurs at home to Stoke and then Spurs at home to Everton in successive weeks, I think they were, you'd have a hard job seeing a gulf between Stoke and Everton. And this was an Everton team that had really refound itself, had been on really quite a substantial long run, I think something like 6 wins, 3 draws. The stats were showing they were running further distances and harder than they had any time of the season. There was even kind of crazy murmurs around Koeman being a contender as a replacement for Enrique at Barcelona. So it was all set for Everton there. I didn't see them getting beaten. Spurs, of course, Spurs are a good side, but then Spurs had looked vulnerable at Anfield two, 3 weeks ago. Bounced back against Stokes. You think, yeah, Spurs, flat track bullies, but Everton, a big side on the up, showing that they could trouble the top six. They won't just get beaten, certainly not beaten in that way.
The journey thing's the key thing here. When Rob says on the up, and you know, they felt like there was momentum behind Everton, and with this game this weekend, Everton versus West Brom, it very much does dictate who will have momentum for the last 10 games of the season. You said before we spoke to Dan, and you know, Dan said something similar, really. Season over if they lose to Everton. This is, one way or another, it is very much a game which dictates for supporters what the last 10 games of this season feel like.
And I think the fact that both of them come into it off a defeat makes it just that even more interesting, because neither of them, as much as they've got lots of positives to build on from this season, neither of them are that sure about what team they're going to see when they go up, when the game happens. From Everton's perspective, regarding the Tottenham game, I think Tottenham are at that really good run of form at the moment. I think it's something like 9 home wins. Yeah. And so at White Hart Lane, they will probably do that to most teams between now and the end of the season. However, I think Everton's problem sometimes tends to be when they try to change themselves for the opposition. Like they put Barry, Gay,
yeah, they tried to shut
Chamberlain.
It up, didn't they? Yeah,
yeah, and it kind of reminded me in a slightly less way of the Chelsea game where they tried to match up and it just went horribly wrong. I think at the moment,
Koeman is still trying to tinker, still trying to adapt as things go. But I think they've got a formula that works or is working. And at this stage of season, if you've got something that's working, just keep doing it.
It's an interesting thing, what you're saying there, Mo, about that. Everton, because it did remind me a little bit of the Chelsea game, to be honest with you. The only thing that doesn't happen is the go to 3-0, if you know what I mean, in that they looked like they were just about sort of all right, but clearly second best. And then it all goes badly wrong. There's two goals conceded at Chelsea. I think it's 3-0 at half-time, and it's much, much worse. But there were those similarities, and I think this is... I think it's going to be hard for Everton, really, is, you know, without even getting into a conversation around funds, because it's not just about sort of having money, it's also about who you're competing with to buy players. Exactly. There's going to be a lot of feeling as though they've made two steps forward and one step back, I think, over not just the rest of this season, but going into next. But remembering that, obviously, as part of two steps forward, one step back, you end up having made a step forward. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be, you know, difficult at times for supporters to take, because if you do run into a juggernaut like a Harry Kane-inspired Spurs, then it's quite easy. Football supporters aren't stupid. Everton know that if that game's on points, they've mm-hmm. got beat about 4-1, not 3-2. Yeah.
Well, I think that... when it comes to the end of the season, Everton will be able to look back at the season, and the things that they got out of it would be Koeman, Tom Davis, Lookman, and a slightly more solid-looking midfield.
And Lukaku.
And Lukaku, of course. And hopefully, by that point, he'll have signed a new contract, so they won't have the same willy-won'ty they've had the last couple of summers. If they can get all of those things in place for the start of pre-season, before you even start looking at playing Edmonds, then you've got something positive to build from. You're not trying to pack in as many players as you can. There's not going to be as high a turnover for next season, which means that you will be able to adapt a little bit quicker.
I think what happens from here on in is vital for Everton, because they don't want another groundhog season on their hands. No. They stayed loyal to David Moyes for a number of years, and there's debates on this, but he did a good job at Everton. But I still think the supporters got frustrated with the no man's land in the league they were under with Moyes. Martinez comes in. They have a better version of a Moyes season with a different style of football, and then a huge number of points, and then it goes backwards quickly. Koeman's an interesting manager. I mean, looking at his record at Southampton, he's quite streaky. And last season he has a half decent start, a very bad run, and then he recovers strongly. This season, good start, very bad run, good recovery. I just wonder for Everton, this is a big game for them, I think, quietly. I think I could very easily see this being a draw if Everton don't come out of the traps quickly here. Could easily be a draw. They'd have gone two matches without a win. I think there'll be a big deflating of the optimism that's been around if this is a draw for them. And I could see there being a patchy run-in for them. And I think if they hit the season... Maybe they will get seventh, but seventh with a poor points total that doesn't entirely convince them about Koeman, that won't set them up well.
I think, well, just very quickly for me on that, the thing about Everton, which I think they've got, which will help them even if they draw against West Brom, is being able to play Holgate, Davis, Lookman, and even Calvert-Lewin. I think that's good for them in terms of the fact that nothing galvanises a crowd, and also teammates, like being able to look at young blood in a dressing room. I think that would hugely help. But I do agree that, you know, they need to feel as though they keep moving forward. Next one is Hull Swansea that we're looking at, and Mo, it's one that Hull have got to win. There's been lots of talk of the good football they played under the manager. You know, a couple of really good performances / results against Liverpool and Manchester United. But they didn't get the win that they needed last weekend. And it does seem as though if they are going to pull themselves out of the quagmire and keep the sides above them in, including Swansea, it's got to be all 3 points this weekend.
Very much so. I mean, all of the goodwill Marco Silva initially had is starting to fizzle out. It's three without a win now. And you start to feel like you're looking at the games coming up for them, where they're going to get those wins from. They have to be targeting this game. Obviously, it's a 6-pointer anyway. All the teams down there are in that, looking at those games. But more than ever, for them at home, to give them that one last push, because they lose this game and results go their way, the two of them are Sunderland to cut adrift already.
I think that's massive, Rob. I mean, you know, you look at this. If they beat Swansea, they find themselves 3 points behind Swansea. If they lose to Swansea, they're 9 points behind Swansea with 10 games to go. And nothing you've seen all season suggests they're going to make that up. So that would suggest that Swansea are one of the sides that have gone. Middlesbrough have forced themselves very much into the bottom three contention. Well done them. They'll put some serious performances in to do that. But, you know, it's difficult to sort of, if Swansea beat them, you don't see Leicester falling in. We're going to have a chat about Bournemouth in a minute, but you don't see Leicester falling back at this stage either now. And so you end up in a situation where if you are Hull, it does just begin to look like a really, really tough job.
Yeah, and we can say that they're targeting this one, but Swansea will be targeting this one. Swansea look at this game and go, yeah, they're shaking. We're actually... It's like the form team in the division, but you know
top four since the start of 2017.
There, there you go. They've got to be going there with that kind of with a confidence that says, you know, we can win this. And I think if the manager would say to them, win this, and you actually can start looking up the table now. They're not safe, but they could almost say, well, we've all but put Hull to bed. Was that a 6-point gap if they over Hull? If they
9-point gap.
Well, no. Well, there you go. That is putting Hull to bed really at this stage with relegation. Team's form, and they can actually start looking up the table and say, you know what, our rightful place is as a mid-table side. We've established ourselves in the Premier League. That would be a platform to build on for next season, I think. Renewed faith in a manager, renewed faith, a new project off the ground. They've had a wobbly couple of years, haven't they, since Laudrup left, really. Yes. It would really, really set them up, I think, to have another look at another 5 years in the top flight, really.
I agree, definitely. I think from
it's a lot of pressure on one game, by the way. Hold on, right?
Well, this is what happens at this time of the season, Neil. All the games ramp up in pressure.
It's the most important game in their history, I'd say.
The most important game that they've ever played in their lives. Maybe not the most important game they've ever played in their lives, but certainly the most important game this season to date. I think that obviously Swansea are going to go into it with a lot more confidence. I think for Hull City, they need to find a way to score goals again. I mean, Grosicki, the Polish club who's come in, he looks like he's got a bit of quality he can provide. Mbakani being out is probably not going to do them that much harm because he just doesn't look like a guy who's going to score goals in the Premier League. And I don't know why it's taken two or three teams to see it. It's just not happening for him.
Mbakani, it's absolutely mad. Very quickly, give me a prediction on this one, Rob.
1-0 to Swansea.
1-0 Swansea?
I'm going to say 2-1 to Hull.
2-1 to Hull?
Yep.
I'm going to go 3-2 Swansea. That's partially.
I want to watch your game.
Yeah, my game. My game is the game to watch. Liverpool Burnley next, Rob. And Liverpool needs to stop messing about. Really, I mean, it would be
most important game in our history.
Yeah, it's there's a lot to be said for the game from a Liverpool point of view. It's but there sort of shouldn't be. And the strange thing is that with the possible exception of the Swansea result, you know, Liverpool drop points at home to Swansea. They West Ham get a really hard fought 2-2 at Anfield. And I think that's the start of the West Ham turnaround, really, is they run themselves into the ground for that 2-2 at Anfield. And Liverpool aren't great that day. But apart from that, Liverpool's home form is actually pretty good in the league. Mm. And yet everyone's looking at this going, feels like a massive potential banana skin this for Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, the reason it's a banana skin is Liverpool haven't put back-to-back results together since they beat Manchester City. Stoke and Manchester City. In fact, I think that might have been part of a four-match winning sequence, but they haven't put back-to-back results for quite some time. Liverpool's 2017 form as a whole has been dreadful, but it's been improving. There have been three significant possibilities to turn a corner now. A very feisty home draw with Chelsea. We followed up by defeat against Hull. A really good, or near thrashing of Tottenham, followed up by a defeat at Leicester. And so here we are again. Again, Groundhog Day type feelings. But I think this is different. And I hope I'm not tempting fate. I think Burnley are the right opponents for Liverpool right now. They're not in the pits of the relegation struggle. There's no danger of them looking towards the upper part of the table and any outside Europa hopes. Yes, they can play with a certain freedom if they so choose. But I would think Liverpool's newfound hunger, a good week to work at it. I think Liverpool will find a way to beat Burnley, and I suspect quite convincingly.
Liverpool have found themselves with three home games in the next four: the home against Burnley, away at Manchester City, home against Everton, home against Bournemouth. It's fair to say, Mo, that in a normal season, you get to go, you put the Man City one to one side and you look at the three homes and you go, if we get 9 points from that, anything from Man City is a bonus. But that's, again, this season, that's felt now. Again, feelings more than reality because, as I say, they've dropped points against Swansea and West Ham, and apart from that, there's no one Liverpool have faced at home that they've dropped points against that they maybe shouldn't have done. So feelings more than reality, but you do feel as though a lot of that's going to be dictated by what happens against Burnley. Liverpool can't keep going to the well of, well, we'll get ourselves out of trouble at the Etihad. There's every chance they go to the Etihad, Man City turn it on, and Liverpool get done 3-0.
Well, exactly. I mean, the problem with relying on the big games to get us out of trouble is that one of these days we are going to lose one. And then if we're losing the big games and not picking up the other points, then we're just playing badly. However, I think
like you say, Rob, this
can't argue with the facts.
That's it. All of the potential excuses are, yeah, well this, yeah, well that. They'll have all been exhausted by that point. But no, I think this is different to the Hull and the Leicester games, not just because it's at Anfield, but I think that, like you say, Burnley, the only thing they've really got to play for is an away win. That's what they haven't had one all season. They'd probably like to have one to kind of cap off the great season that they've had. They've come a little bit closer in their last two games than they have done. It's almost like they're almost there. So from that point of view, they could be a threat. But I still believe that if we do what we're supposed to do, specifically in the first 20 minutes, the first 20 minutes are going to be crucial. Any chances we get, we need to take them. We need to start that game as if they've all been hypnotised to think that there's Arsenal out there, not Burnley.
It's a free hit for Burnley, and that is one of the things. But that's a double-edged sword, I think, Rob, in that.
Yeah.
I think that the way when Sean Dyche has built his football team this season, it's very much to he set them up quite similarly now, home and away. He's seen the proof of the pudding in terms of the home wins that they've got, but it's led to them not winning away from home. But they've not been embarrassed anywhere. It's important to say that they haven't been embarrassed. They haven't been shipping fives and sixes. They just haven't been winning the game. But the other side of that, though, is that they're now in a situation where they can think, well, you know what, if we can frustrate this Liverpool side, that's fine. But what I think we'll actually see is Burnley will not change what they do, no matter what the scoreline is at any point. So there won't be this idea that Liverpool get 2-0 up, oh, now Burnley will have to come and play. That won't happen, I don't think. Burnley will just keep doing the same thing over and over again. The only difference to what they do at home is that they're 10, 15 yards deeper.
Yeah, I think they're well up to they're well set up to exploit a nervy Liverpool performance. It's the crowd are going to be interesting at Anfield. There's no doubt the crowd sense blood when the likes of Arsenal and Tottenham roll into town, and that's why Liverpool are capable of getting some of the results they get. You contrast that with Liverpool at home to Swansea about 6 weeks ago. The crowd just were there to make up the numbers and see Liverpool get a routine win. It was early in the day, I'll stress.
It was.
I think it might help Liverpool that this one is getting towards tea time. I think it's at 4:30 kick.
4:30 Sunday.
Albeit, I think I'd rather on a Saturday. I think the crowd
would... Saturday 5:30 would be better.
Saturday 5:30 would be better, but it's a damn sight better than these saccharine 12:30 kickoffs. But if Liverpool sort of look at Burnley and Burnley sit deep and Liverpool get, overthink it, overplay it early on, and they just see that a great big bus parked, claret and blue bus parked in front of them and have doubts, then I think Burnley will be well set to exploit it, and I'd worry for Liverpool.
Well, that's why, in my perspective, the fast start is not crucial for the way Burnley are going to play. It's crucial for how Liverpool are going to play. It's crucial for how the crowd are going to react, how we're going to stay... Because, I mean, in all intents and purposes, if it's 0-0 at half-time, the crowd are going to be nervous based on what we've seen previously. But if we have got that 2-0 lead, everyone relaxes a bit more. Mistakes, every little mistake or mispass isn't going to hear the sharp intake of breath. The players, therefore, relax. They get into their football more. They become more clinical. We run out 3-1, 4-1 winners and everyone's happy.
Prediction, Mo?
3-1.
3-1. Rob?
2-0.
2-0. Okay. Bournemouth, West Ham. Talk about that next. The Harry Redknapp Derby. I had a chat with Andy Middleton before about West Ham, and here's what he had to say. Joined now by Andy Middleton here on 50-50 Football to talk about West Ham United and a season that's petered out away at Bournemouth at the weekend. We'll come on to talk about that game. Drop points just by one goal against Chelsea on Monday night. But it's been a season without anywhere near as many laughs as last season, really, Andy, if we're honest. It's just become a points harvesting project.
Yeah, it's quite bordering on the mundane now in terms of just saying two or three wins and we're safe, and that's the season done and plan for next season. So, yeah, it's a strange sort of feeling now. I'd all the talk saying, just to have one big night there, we could have had something against Chelsea, or I know we've still got you guys still to come down. Just to get a couple of big scouts at the new stadium would be quite nice before the end of the season, just so we feel like we're starting to make a bit of history in a new home. But other than that, there isn't a lot to look forward to for the rest of the season.
It's a strange one because it's an interesting weekend around, I think, sort of what happens to side to find themselves marooned a little bit in the middle of the table with not a lot to play for at this stage of the season, because obviously out of the cup as well, and there's the cup games going on.
Yeah.
And I think there's...
Yeah.
The West Ham thing, I think what you want to feel from your football team is that they're moving forward. And I still can't work out whether or not West Ham are this season from afar. I mean, I don't know how it feels for you. There was a terrible start. Does it feel like it's moving forward again?
I don't think it feels like it's moved forward, no. I think, as I've said on here many times, we're going to be shopping for the players in the summer that we were shopping for last summer without success. And I think that's a concern and shouldn't have happened. And, you know, where we brought in about 11 or 12 rather than 3 or 4 quality players, we're going to be in the same position. And when you watch teams, all right, they're exceptional, but you watch it against the likes of Chelsea, we don't really have those X-factor players. We've got a very good squad of reasonable Premiership professionals who'll do a job and get us where we are. But to move forward as a club, we need to add some quality all through the side of three or four top players. And I think the disappointing thing for us is because we didn't do that last summer, you don't move forward. And if in this league you stand still, you go backwards. So we've now got a bigger job to do in the summer in looking for those, in looking for that striker and that fullback and that centre midfield player.
I think that's the, again, from afar, you know, that's one of the things that I can see is clearly a problem. I mean, you can see the difference that Carroll makes when he plays, but you can't rely on him.
Yeah.
And also, he dictates that you play a very specific way as well. You can see that, for instance, Snodgrass is a tidy sign, and you can see how he becomes the logical choice if Payet's going. But then, you know, you can also see the quality of Fonte, but he's 31. It is a strange situation that you've ended up in, really, where I think it happens to every. I mean, for instance, Spurs last season, they'd have sat around, they'd have said, we need a decent attack midfielder and we need a centre forward, and they bought Sissoko and Janssen, and they spent 48 million and they're actually no better for it. So that shows, doesn't it, that not only have you got to try and do this stuff, but you might have to try and do it 2 or 3 times at the best of times. And that's the issue really for West Ham, is they haven't even tried properly.
No, exactly. And I think, you know, you look at it and I think it is a real problem now, and we've discussed it, but if you're going to move forward, definitely move forward, because I think signings like Snodgrass and Fonte are good signings for us. As you said, they're good, very good Premiership players. So there's a bit of quality there and can do a job. But if you really want to move forward, if we're going to compete, as the owners have said, with you know, guys like you and Tottenham and the like, where they've gone out and when they wanted what they did and bought in people like Wanyama, they're doing that top-end, proven Premiership professionals. But then to go to the next level, when we're looking at, I don't know, Lacazette, who we're looking at in the summer, they're now talking about 60 or 70 million for him. About a guy who may or may not make it in the Premier League. So I honestly don't know where we go. I know what we want. You know, all the rumours still persist that we'd love to take Mr. Sturridge. Again, you look at his injury record, he'd do 40, 50 million for someone who plays 20 games a season. It's not easy for the owners. I'm not saying it's an easy thing to find those players that take you to that next level, but
There's been a lot of patience towards the manager again. You know, it looked to me as though both from the owners and from the supporters, he's got a certain amount of goodwill. I think the Payet stuff sort of happened at a nice time for him in terms of, you know, it galvanised a couple of performances in there. It also got him some results. It made people pick a side and they fell down on his, broadly speaking. Is he likely to be under review in the summer, or do you think he's going to lead the side into next season?
I think he'll be in. I'll be very surprised if he's not in for next season. I think the two things, there is an awful lot of goodwill towards him from the fans. He is one of those, obviously, you've seen what's happened with Ranieri, that doesn't always get you very far, but, you know, there's a lot of goodwill from the fans. He's a thoroughly decent man by all accounts and from everything you see. And if you look outside, again, when you look at the performances of some managers, you think, if you changed him out, would you get anyone any better? So, you know, you can only work with what he has in front of him to a point. And if you're arguing about the difference between finishing 9th and 7th, then I don't think you'd want to go through the upheaval. And where we are at the moment, and even I think looking at some of the players we may bring in, if I look at how the six, or the so-called top six, will probably spend this summer, we're always going to be a long way behind them in for the next 3 to 5 years. So I don't see the upheaval of changing the manager would get us anything in terms of improved results. It's been worrying sometimes how we've capitulated in a few games, but I think, you know, there were other factors involved in that. And we'll see as we go in the summer.
Well, I was going to say, the other thing that therefore throws open isn't just the idea of what are West Ham going to think about with reference to Ings, but then also he's had a good year, and now he's had a year with a fair bit of adversity, which as a club everyone's coming out the other side of. So can you see him wielding the knife a little bit then? Because I think that's the other thing. When a manager gets in and is safe and has had 2 years with a set of footballers, he does sometimes begin to have a real sense of who he still wants to be working with going into the following season.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing we'll see, is how ruthless he can be. Because I think there is a very, very big decision waiting, which we haven't made, And probably the thing I would criticise him for in making a weak manager decision in terms of picking your best 11 players and then putting him in a position. Because since Obiang came in and started playing like he has, he's the most undroppable player, I'll say, on our side at the moment, which when Kouyaté comes back, leaves a question about Noble. But if you're talking on quality and form, Noble shouldn't be starting. So you've got an issue of your club captain and team captain probably isn't worth his place. And his way of getting around it is to play Kouyaté right back, which I think is a, you know, in inverted commas, a coward's way out. We should play a right back at right back and play our best two centre midfield players if we're going to play that formation. And harsh as it is on Mark, he doesn't get in the side on that form.
I've noticed that all season. I thought he was excellent last season, Noble. I think there is a bit of a miles in the legs problem for him now. It's not that he's old, but it's that I think the tempo that so many of these games are played at becomes, you know, if you've been running around for as long as he has, you've only got to lose sort of 2 or 3%, and suddenly it gets harder and harder.
Yeah, it does. I do think, you know, the London Stadium is a bigger expanse of a pitch, and you play a different sort of game. And I think the energy and power that Obiang and Kouyaté bring to those two positions in front of the back four, if we continue to play that way, there's not a position for us. So that's a big decision, and we're probably not going to make it this year, or that we should, but it's a big decision going into next year.
Looking at the weekend's game, then, you're mentioning, you know, away at Bournemouth, the Harry Redknapp derby. It's an interesting occasion. You know, they're desperate for a win. It is the old thing about sort of, you know, buckets and spades and all that sort of stuff this early for a number of sides, not just West Ham in the Premier League. It is a bit of a challenge, isn't it? It may be easier for Bilic in a sense to say, listen, you owe your supporters, slow start to the season, lad. Yeah. You owe your supporters, your own professionalism, your own sense of class. And also last season you finished relatively high up the table. Let's get as high as we can. I mean, that might be how he's looking at it, but some of these games are going to end up looking a bit difficult for West Ham to get up for.
Yeah. In fairness to the team, I would say that for the last few games, you know, the Watford game, the West Brom game, that, you know, you could have said fell into that. I thought we deserved to win both of those games and look bang up for both of them. So I'm not that concerned about them going on holiday yet. I think, you know, I think there'll be a few more performances out of them before the end of the season. And I hopefully can get into them that they're actually playing for something. And then, as I said, it's going to be a big... It's going to be a big summer for us, but you know, I think they'll go in and put in performance in Bournemouth. But with the way we played this year, we're still a bit. You don't know which one's going to turn up. We could go down there and win 3-0 or lose 3-0. I wouldn't be surprised by either.
But the one positive is Carroll, because Bournemouth haven't looked great at the back. They've looked a little bit ropey, and if there's one thing that Carroll's very, very good at, if you've got a couple of underlying weaknesses with the ball being slung in the air, he'll find a way to make them pay.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, as I said, and with those last few games before his groin problem, he actually, on the ground, the goal he scored against Southampton, where he just, you know, a great late run between the two centre-backs. He's looked a really quality centre-forward. And if you could rely on the strength of his body, he would be the man we built the team around. Because he's more than just in the air, and he really makes a difference. And I think what we'd actually got with him was they'd found a way to play him with Antonio just off him. And that was a problem with Chelsea, where Chelsea, you know, could keep a relatively high line because we had no one who could run in behind. Teams can't do that if he's got Antonio playing off him. And those two together were giving teams real problems for the first 5 or 6 games they played together. Antonio's back after his ban. So, yeah, you know, those two, Carroll's there and Antonio's there. I fancy to give anyone a go.
I think we say this a lot, but certainly I think for the sides that are sort of seventh, I think for the sides at the top, or for the sides that are sort of seventh down to 16th, you are, so much of what you do is dictated by what's going to happen at the top end of the pitch.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, you know, we've been ineffective there for most of this year, either missing Carroll, or, you know, playing strikers, playing a lone striker who gets so exposed. All of that has been wrong. And I think it does, you know, won those games that recent turnaround of form when Carroll was back and we played someone up with him to get support into the box, and you've got both of them are big lads, good in the air, pace, power, those sorts of things. Might sound basic, but you win more than you lose, I think, if you've got two players like that up top.
No, undoubtedly so. Do you want to give me a quick prediction then for the game against Bournemouth?
I think we'll win 2-1.
I want to just say 3-0 in either way. 0-3 or 3-0. Great to speak to Andy. Let's find out what everybody else thinks. West Ham very much in the midst of a season that you can write off there, Andy, going through that with us, which is fantastic. But Bournemouth, Rob, they just need to get themselves 3 points. 3 points from anywhere, and it banishes all the demons, all the wolves from the door. But until there is a 3 points for Bournemouth, they can get plucky 1-1s at Manchester United till the cows come home. They need to get themselves 3 points in the bag so that they can begin to say, right, there's a gap between us and them.
Yes, but they have got a win in them, Bournemouth. They have got a goal in them. I think we talked about this the other week. Even in defeat at Everton, I think it's 6-3. So they get their goal at Old Trafford. And that's a big result they got at Man United. I think it'll have fired them up, all the controversy around it. It's interesting. I think they start without Jack Wilshere, didn't they, at United?
Yeah.
Will they start with him again? Will they see it as an occasion to be a bit more expansive? I think they will. They're good at home, generally. West Ham looked pretty woeful against Chelsea after a bright start. We talk about targeting. If this is Bournemouth, if you're Eddie Howe, you're targeting this one like a motherfucker. Yeah. there's no other two ways about it.
Three big red circles around it on the board.
Yes, if they lost, they'd suddenly start to be shitting their proverbials. But they do feel like they can get a win from somewhere, mm-hmm. and I think this might be the one for them.
I think it's looking like this could be their one. I mean, as much as you're right, they've got Josh King at the moment, who's in a great goal.
He's in a great run.
He's looking like he's finally comfortable with what the manager asks of him, his place in the team. But for me, it's the defensive performance they put up with 10 men in that second half. That's what's going to see them through. Because obviously they're not going to have Tyrone Mings for the next few games, but young Cargill came in. He didn't have any alarms at all. Big game, Old Trafford, that's going to do him the world of good.
It's a run of fixtures, really, Mo, as well. It's Bournemouth, West Ham this weekend, then it's Bournemouth, but then they entertain Swansea at home, then it's Southampton away, a derby. You'll feel as though they've got a good record against Southampton since they came back up. Then they've got a couple of tough games, Liverpool, Chelsea and Spurs all back to back, but then it's Bournemouth, Middlesbrough, Sunderland, Bournemouth, Bournemouth at home to Stoke, Bournemouth at home to Burnley. My point about this is that if they just win this one this weekend, as much as you can say, well, it's still not done, because it isn't, you can look at the rest of them and feel as though, well, there's two wins in them for them and a couple of points, and then that does get them over the finish line. What it might do, though, because I felt last season watching Bournemouth, you felt like, if I say Eddie Howe cracked it, it'd be slightly wrong, but you felt like they were a football team with a formula. Yes. And up until about January this season, the same thing happened. Now, it might be that Eddie Howe looks at it and thinks, well, it's just a bad run of form. It happens to every side who's like us, but they may want to tweak one or two things. I don't think the signings in the summer have gone quite as well as they'd hope. You know, it might be that you see a slightly different Bournemouth next season.
I think so. I mean, obviously, Jack Wilshere's probably not going to be there next season, and he was kind of their big new adaptation. Obviously, Jordan Ibe as well hasn't really worked out for them so far this season. But I think when the stage they're in their Premier League life, you need to start adapting. I mean, even all the best teams who've stayed up, Stoke probably being the best example, they had to go away from what got them that initial success by that point, because people start figuring them out. And if you aren't able to do that by the third season, you will end up going down.
Yeah, I think that's the trick now, I think, isn't it, for Bournemouth, Rob, is that if they can just sort of get through the season, I think they're going to be all right. And I think one of the reasons why I also think they're going to be all right is I think they'd be more worried if right now there was one of certainly Middlesbrough or Hull had four more points. I think then you'd begin to think, oh no, we might need to find a way to get three or four wins. We might need to find a way to get to 40 rather than probably 36, 38. But they are going to maybe have to have a little rethink about what's worked so far.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that would, the biggest comfort they've got is that those three sides, the negative momentum with those sides is a bit special. They're not seeing where their next point's coming from. Middlesbrough look a very depressed outfit. Sunderland, well, they're not even worth talking about in terms of where they're next going to find a win. So from Bournemouth's point of view, I think Eddie Howe would be cautioned. Just stay calm. Mm-hmm. Just stay calm. Yeah, we can win the next one, we lose. As you said, Neil, you look at that run of fixtures. That's one of the things that people often forget at this stage of the season when you look at some teams' positions. I've done it with looking at Liverpool's fixtures, and you go, do you know what? We've played everyone now. We've only got City left. We've played everyone.
And Crystal Palace.
Some teams are in sort. Yeah, some teams are on kind of false positions, and some teams, are going to get some rude awakenings. Because I was looking at one or two rivals at the top. They still got five of the top six to four, four or five of the top six to play. You go, that's just under half your remaining fixtures. You're nowhere sure of where you're going to finish. And Bournemouth, well, we're looking at them and going, you know what? They've got a lot of games that they fall into, and we can target this mode.
The one problem they've got though, Rob, is, and it's a problem that I think, you know, Callum Wilson's a massive blow. Losing him's a massive blow. He hasn't been bagging them in this season, far from it. And if anything, you know, King, there was some clamour for King to play up top ahead of him. Yeah. But but just simply having the option of him with the pace, with what he does, the way in which he stretches sides, I think, you know, losing them the way in which they have, it's a blow for them. It's a blow for them this season. It's a blow for them looking into next season as well, because it's such a bad injury for a player who was exciting.
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, and you count your game changers, match winners on a couple of fingers when you're at that end of the table. And as you say, looking ahead for Bournemouth, what they do in the market this summer is going to be important. They've sort of got away with it this year. You know, they're the sort of side that need to be greater than the sum of their parts, and Eddie Howe's been exceptional in achieving that thus far. But it'll only get them so far. Having a guy like Callum Wilson doing what he was doing will only get them so far. They need to get it right in the transfer. They have to be, as Rafa Benitez once said, perfect in the transfer market this summer.
FA Cup next, after we've gone through all the league games there. Well done, everyone. Not a load of them, but you know, I thought everyone held up their end of the bargain.
Is that all the league games?
That is all the league games this weekend that we're going to get. Middlesbrough versus Manchester City in the FA Cup. City held by Stoke. It's massive for Chelsea and Spurs, really, that one, Mo. I think that's a useful momentum killer for those two sides when that happened last night. But Middlesbrough thoroughly depressed. We had Dan Gray on from talking about Butter on the Monday version of this show. He was as ever fantastic. It is no fun. It is absolutely no fun at the minute for Middlesbrough. Maybe this can act as a bit of a relief, but it won't act as a bit of a relief if Man City are 3-0 in half an hour.
I mean, I just want to say that Wednesday result wasn't bad for us as well, by the way.
No, it wasn't bad for Liverpool at all.
But no, I agree. I think from Middlesbrough's perspective, you're looking around for something positive to cling on to, and there is very little. Because even their strong defensive performance, it's not really getting them anywhere. I mean, with all the will in the world, their goal difference, theirs and Palace's goal difference, is slightly better than the others.
Than everyone else's, yet.
However, that's only going to be an issue if they're on the same amount of points. If they can't get as many wins as them, it doesn't matter if they go down with like a 20 goal better goal difference.
I think it very much is showing. It's showing a couple of things. The Middlesbrough thing, Rob. You know, with an eye on the league, but also an eye on the FA Cup. For instance, if you know that this is the first game of the weekend that's televised in the FA Cup, and if Middlesbrough go 1-0 down, they're at home. If they go 1-0 down on about 15-20 minutes, if I'm watching that game, I'm probably not really watching it that much, that closely for that much longer. You know, as horrible as that sounds, you're thinking, well. And even though Man City themselves have leaked a few goals this season, though that actually, interestingly, has began to slow down, you're still thinking to yourself, well, you know, how on earth do they get back into this? They probably won't be able to get the ball off Manchester City. Manchester City can hit them on the break in the blink of an eye. They've also got tons of players who are capable of doing two very good things to put it in the back of the net, or one brilliant thing. It just becomes, you know, that it's a game that's only really got your attention whilst it's level.
Yeah, it is a game that, you know, you think it's 0-4. That's kind of what. But I'm going to steam my neck out and go, I think there's a shock here, and I'll tell you for why. I think it's a cup weekend. It's a bit of a reprieve for Middlesbrough, in as much as I think they can relax a little bit. They've really got nothing to lose. They may be terrible, but they're Premiership level terrible. I think City don't start well and score in the first half hour, Guardiola could confuse his own side by wanting to make changes ahead of Monaco next week. They're looking at the top of the table. They've got bigger fish to fry, quite frankly, Man City, than this game. So I could see a distraction. Look, so I'm having my cake and eating it here. It's either 4-0 to City or 1-0 to Borough.
I honestly think Guardiola would have to pick himself in goal for Middlesbrough to get anything out of this game.
Okay.
I seem to remember a few years ago, in fact, it might be about 10 years ago, Middlesbrough actually went away to City, won 1-0, and didn't have any shots on target at all. The one goal was an own goal. If that happens, they've got a chance. I don't mean to be glib about this, but I genuinely think that Middlesbrough really don't have a chance this game. I think you're right. I think one goal probably brings two very quickly, and it brings a very, very depressed, angry crowd. And they don't seem like a squad that are together. After the last game last week, Ben Gibson was very vocal, saying that he looked around and didn't see everyone putting in as much effort as they should be.
Yep.
Now, when you start hearing that from the captain after a game, if they don't get a reaction from that next week, pretty much pack up and go home.
Going to talk to Natasha Henry in a second about Arsenal, and Gary from the Stacey West blog about Lincoln. But before we do that, little thing on Arsenal, Rob, because they are endlessly fascinating at the moment. The capitulation against Munich. They are the hottest show in town in many ways, because this now, And the thing is, and I'll keep saying it, it wouldn't surprise me. They beat Lincoln, they win the next league game. They get themselves back onto a relatively even keel and find some sort of way to pull themselves back into the top four and possibly make the cup final and maybe even win the thing. That could happen. But on the other hand, for the first time, really, it's moved from the idea of the feeling that there is that Arsenal are wobbling a little bit to the actual use of the word crisis maybe being valid.
Yeah, the heat has never been hotter in the kitchen for Arsenal. I mean, it probably started getting warm 2-3 seasons ago now, and it's got worse and worse. The problem at the moment is I don't think he'll even be given credit, or the side will be given credit for the odd win here and there, and that will affect them. I think every goal will be seen as a cataclysmic disaster and further evidence that he just has to go. And I think they're almost at a stage where they score a goal, there's a big portion of the crowd that don't want them to do it. In my lifetime, I mean, it seems crazy to be making this comparison, but there was a phase towards during Roy Hodgson's brief reign at Liverpool where a big portion of the Liverpool crowd actively didn't want Liverpool to score goals or prosper. And it's crazy that the greatest manager in Arsenal history finds himself in this position. It's beyond tragic. But it doesn't feel like Arsenal can just perform the normal Arsenal Wenger trick, which is to quietly go about their business after a mini crisis, get some wins on the board, and then find themselves third and winning a cup.
Well, I think the interesting thing is going to be how the players react, because in past seasons, whenever it's got to that point, the players have always played for him. They've always been like, okay, our manager's under fire. It's up to us to get him out of that fire. And they normally turn it around. But I think some of his autonomy has actually really been watered down this season, particularly to the point where a lot of the players are thinking, well, there's a chance I'm going to be here longer than he is. So maybe I don't need to do that. Maybe I can just kind of bide my time, see who the next guy's going to be and what make up his mind.
Well, there's mutiny out there this week.
There's bits and pieces of mutiny. Oakley Chamberlain's the latest one. I spoke to Natasha about it earlier on. This is what she had to say. And then straight after her, we'll speak to Gary from the Stacey West blog. Felt like we needed a break from Sam Walker-Dyne talking about Arsenal on 50-50 football. He's had a terrible few days, so we've had to tag him out and bring Natasha Henry in. It might feel somewhat Arsenal-heavy at the moment, but it is the most interesting story in British football all of a sudden, really, in a sense, Natasha, because there is all the emotional sort of building blocks around Arsene Wenger, his future, what's going to happen next, the idea that it'd be a massive leap into the unknown for Arsenal. I just really want to get a flavour of what your opinion is on it, really. You know, I'll ask you the key question. Do you want Arsene Wenger to be Arsenal manager at the start of next season?
No, I don't. But with that said, I'm not a fan of the whole Wenger out, Arsene knows best brigade. I just think it's the best thing for the club. So, you know, he was never going to leave mid-season. He was never going to do that. No matter whether we were fighting relegation, I couldn't have seen him walking out mid-season. So I hope everyone knows that he's going to go at the end of the season. We need to start thinking towards the future. But let's not be so angry. Let's enjoy the last few months. Everyone's so angry.
Everyone is angry, but I think one of the reasons is that I think that there's still the perception that he might not go. And that, you know, that'd be a really strange situation, really, if he felt as though he had more to give. There's still, I mean, you know, it's still perfectly plausible that Arsenal turn around and finish in the top four and win the FA Cup this season. At which point then does the manager turn around and go, well, I'm delivering silverware and I've got you another top four finish. So, you know, this is theoretically what we want. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why people are a bit angry, is that I suspect it would obviously dissipate straight away if he declared he was going to go at the end of the season and let's just enjoy these last few months. But he's not saying that.
Yeah, I was thinking about it today with Alonso retiring. Now, I love him. I never understood why Liverpool sold him. But do people just not retire at the end of the season anymore? Do we have to go through these weeks of mourning and saying how wonderful they were? And I don't think Wenger saying if he was going at the end of the season or not would change things. I still think there would be this real bitterness around the Emirates that there is now. But at the same point, it's not about him, it's about the owners, it's about the board. They need to be saying, do you know what, we're taking the contract off the table and we're looking for someone else. You know, they have to make that decision because he's not going to quit, if that makes sense.
No.
But I think he needs a nudge in the right direction. I think he needs a David Dean to say, look, mate, you know,
Well, I mean, that throws open, it's interesting at the minute talk, because we all know so much about how our football clubs operate. That throws open the question of, well, who is that figure at Arsenal? Arsenal did have that figure in David Dean, but, you know, there's a lot of talk, for instance, about the way in which Liverpool's board operates, the way in which Manchester United's board operates even,
yeah.
Which is not conversations, you know, we were having 15 years ago, but we are conscious now that that managers need managing a little bit, and that's quite a it's quite a hard thing. They need that help. On the one hand, they need someone to have the quiet word when the quiet word's required. And that one of the things that's coming out of all this is that I think Arsenal supporters are beginning to look at the club, and Arsenal have been the cliched since the 1920s, 1930s. It just runs itself, it looks after itself type of club. But people are beginning to wonder, well, you know, can these people who are running this football club do it a lot better?
Yeah, I mean, I don't buy into he runs a club, because he's a smart man, but I don't think any one person can run a football club these days. But I do think there are areas where he probably does have too much say. You know, if he's interviewing Gazidis and people like that before they get in their job, that is a step too far. But that's where all the problems have come from, that they've given him this much power, which means things have slipped on the pitch or in the scouting processes or injuries. Look at the amount of injuries we have. So therefore, they have to take responsibility. I don't know Sir Chips, who's got the best name ever, but we don't hear from you from year to year. We only hear from you when they bring you out to, like, unveil a statue or something. Now you want to comment. That shows that there's a lot more going on up there than probably we think or even know at the moment.
There is the next part of this isn't just the Wenger thing. It's also the way in which the season's unfolded. And there's also untold pressure on players. Talk of some wanting to leave. They all appear to have their own little stories around why they want to leave. Oxlade-Chamberlain's the latest to come out. And when I've been watching Arsenal the last few weeks, I think he's come out with a certain amount of credit. I think he's looked like he's got tons and tons of desire to see the football club and the football team do better. What was meant to be sort of portrayed on the internet as a bit of petulance, I thought was actually a player who was very frustrated with his teammates after he's just done three shuttle runs and no one's come to help him.
It's funny, isn't it? It's funny that everyone's praising Sanchez for doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Sanchez does it and it's, oh, he's wonderful. Look, he's annoyed that he got taken off. Let your manager make that decision. But the Ox does it. And I mean, that's very much a media thing in that he's English. So, of course, he's angry. Of course, he's disgruntled. You know, he can't just be a passionate young player that is not happy with events going on around him. It really is as simple as that. Not that I condone the Sanchez kind of sulking thing, but the Ox doesn't show that kind of reaction often. So it shows that there is obviously a lot worse things going on than maybe what we're reading in the paper around the actual club.
I think that this is... again, the idea of what happens next, and this is why it is so fascinating, because, you know, I've seen, for instance, what happens when managers go at Liverpool, and you've seen it at other clubs. Ferguson's an example that's often cited, but there's more than just those examples. It is sometimes difficult. It would feel like an enormous reckoning for almost everyone at Arsenal if it was to change, because you'd soon find out, you know, whether or not the issue is the players, or whether or not the issue has been the way in which they've been coached, or the board, or have a greater sense of where the lines are drawn in all of this. And that's why it's, as I say, why I almost can't stop talking about it. It's one of the things that's closest to my lips all the time, you know, off the back of the 5-1 win against Bayern Munich, and everyone just falls to pieces after Koscielny gets sent off. And you're looking at those lads going, well, you've got to be able to organise yourselves. You're a football team. You'd think you can just get this sorted out so as not to be disgraced. And yet there it goes again. And I think, you know, there's so many of those, you know, Walcott goes from week to week looking occasionally abject, and then it's fantastic first half against Munich. It's so many of the players have these strange question marks over them about whether or not they are actually genuinely elite footballers. And you'd wonder...
I think Arsenal for a long time have got sympathy because of Wenger. And if he goes this season, next season, we're not going to have that sympathy. If we're eighth before Christmas or in November, it's going to be interesting to watch. If I take myself out of being an Arsenal fan, it'll be great to watch. But you have to wonder if he's been the one that's actually been dragging us to fourth and we didn't even deserve to be there in the first place.
Exactly, and that'll be the thing. And it is one of the things that happens when it feels like it goes bad in a football club. And listen, Arsenal will almost certainly beat Lincoln. We'll come on to talk about that in a second. But they'll almost certainly beat Lincoln, and it wouldn't surprise me if things get straightened out and there's a proper tilt coming back towards the top four. But one of the things that starts happening is that, you know, factions do develop. There'll be Arsenal supporters who haven't got much sympathy for Sanchez, haven't got so much sympathy for Wenger, but have got sympathy for the young lads who they think they're watching week in, week out, try the best. And before you know where you are, everyone's at each other's throats, and that's no atmosphere to watch a game of footy in.
No, not at all. That's why I agree with you. I don't I don't like all the sniping between fans. And I've always, whether it's my club or another club, doesn't get anyone anywhere. I understand people are annoyed. I understand they pay a lot of money for their season tickets, which is their choice. We have to remember that no one is forcing them to go and watch football. If they are that strongly against what's going on, then maybe they should not be renewing their season tickets. That's their choice as well. But I do think it's like booing and shouting and protesting. We are lucky. We're not going to lose our club. I know I'm going to get up next season. Probably when I have kids in 20 years' time, I'll be able to take them to my club. And there is, I think there's a bit of an overreaction to what is actually going on. That said, though, I don't like this whole, you know, Charlton are worse. Yeah, they are, but their expectations are very different than that.
Yeah, of course. And it is all very, very different on that. So looking at the weekend, therefore, against Lincoln, it is a bit of a high to nothing. It's, in many senses, it's the worst possible game in that the extent to which Arsenal are obviously meant to win it, it doesn't act as a pressure valve, does it? You know, if it was a league game away at West Brom and then you go and get 3 points, then everyone can go, there you go, these lads, they're all coming together and getting 3 points on the one hand. On the other hand, if you get beat again, you're able to say, listen, there's something seriously wrong and we need to start doing something about it, maybe a bit more urgently and all of that. Whereas this game's a funny one because obviously if you win it, well, you just should win it. You should just win it regardless. And so it's if you don't win it, then there is the potential of absolute hell to pay. But it would be remarkable if Arsenal didn't find a way past Lincoln.
I mean, we have to just go out and win it, don't we? There's no debate. There's no conversation. There's no who plays and who doesn't. We have to go out there and we have to win a 3-0. We can't just limp over the line because the way things are going right now, you can just imagine the reaction after. If we beat them 1-0, because we win a penalty in the last 10 minutes, that is not going to be a good result for Arsenal. They need to go there and they need to put on a performance. They need to score goals and show Lincoln the utmost respect, because if you go there and you don't, you probably will end up with a draw or a lucky 1-0 win.
What sort of side do you think he's going to put out there in that context? Because I think he is aware that he wants to, again, if you're Arsene Wenger, and someone was actually saying to me on one of the many shows that we do off the back of the Liverpool-Arsenal game, that the thing about Arsene Wenger is he's getting into the territory where he's doing what he thinks is best and maybe not protecting himself as much as some people might like. He's, you know, it would, the easiest thing in the world would, for instance, be to just pick Sanchez against Liverpool, whether you're happy or not, because it won't therefore make you not picking Sanchez and then getting beat the story. And then even then bringing him on at half time, it'd be easier to hang him out to dry and not do the mature thing, which is think, well, how can I get a result in this game of football? So what sort of side do you think he'd go with? Because in years gone by, I'd expect him to go with a bit of a mishmash, have a look at a couple of young lads, whereas obviously he very much needs to win the game.
I think he will still have a bit of a mix. I would expect to see like Rain Adelaide, maybe Chris Willock on the bench, but I think he's still got a strong spine. It's like we spoke about it before, the last cup game. You know, you kind of want him to say to the ones who aren't performing, you know what, go home, have a day off, or come to the stadium and watch a bunch of kids who want it 10 times more than you. But he can't take that risk, because if Arsenal get knocked out of that, that's it. Their season's over. So I do expect maybe like 3 or 4 young players. But it's hard because you look at someone like Alex Iwobi, who's great when he came in, and it's not that he's got bad or that he's even not performing. He's just getting consumed by all the negativity and the losses that are going on. And he's taken that on himself when, as one of the younger members of the squad, he probably doesn't have that much effect on what's going on. So I think he'll maybe put in some young guys, and is it punishment to play some people against Lincoln? Some managers would see it as that, but someone like Sanchez, he'll want to play. So I guess you have to play him.
It's an interesting thing. You know, it's interesting. It's interesting you cite the young players there, because as an example, I remember, you know, I'm not saying by any stretch of the imagination he's gone on and had a startling, astonishing career, but for instance, I remember Emiliano Insua, the back end of Benitez's time at Liverpool, going from looking like a pretty interesting young left back to as though his entire brain was caving in. And then, you know, subsequently he's played for Galatasaray, Sporting, Atletico Madrid, he's now at Stuttgart. You know, he's not setting the world alight, but it is what happens to these young players when they're in these environments, these dressing rooms, all of this sort of stuff, exposing them to it can actually, you know, it can knock them sideways a little bit.
Yeah, because I've seen so-called fans on Twitter sending away the abuse, and I'm like, this is what a 19, 20-year-old boy who's played 50 games, which is amazing for his age. But at the same point, you cannot expect him to drag that team through the mud. by himself. So to be abusing someone like him, but then not sending the same ritual towards a Walcott, towards a Koscielny or Mustafi, or even a Czech, is just pathetic in my head. He's not the one to blame. You'd have to hope that given, like, I mean, his uncle's JJ Okocha, that he's got enough people around him that know about football, but hopefully it won't affect him long term and it will just be a blip. But yeah, I mean, you can't blame him. It's a team game. It's a squad game, so.
Do me a quick prediction. I presume you're going to say Arsenal are going to win.
Oh, 5-0.
5-0. Okay, Natasha Henry, Arsenal in crisis. She goes for a 5-0. Huge thanks to her. Let's get back. And in fact, let's go over and speak to Gary about what Lincoln are going to do. Joined now by Gary Hutchison from the Stacey West blog to talk about Lincoln City. And Gary, you just heard from Natasha there. Obviously, Arsenal are having the problems that they're having, moving in the direction they're moving in. But Lincoln, before we get on even to the Arsenal game, you know, it's worth giving these players enormous credit, really, for the season that they're having. Just beyond the FA Cup, you know, whilst they've had the stress of the FA Cup and the excitement of the FA Cup, they've actually maintained a solid 6-point gap at the top, looking like they're going to get promoted into the Football League this season. And they're also in the semi-final of the FA Trophy.
Yeah, still fighting on all fronts in three competitions. And I think it's credit to the players and managers. I mean, they're showing a real resilience. One week you're playing away at Nantwich, the next you're away at Burnley, then North Ferriby, then Arsenal. I mean, it's as a fan, it's crazy. You never know whether you're going to turn up at a recreation ground or a Premier League stadium at the moment. And as you say, the important business is the National League. 6 points clear of Tranmere and Forest Green at the moment. And that's the real focus. But yeah, you know, they're a brilliant set of lads, absolutely superb.
I mean, before we get on to the manager, really, you say they're a brilliant set of lads. Obviously, you don't get where you're getting to without being a really, really good side, a good team, and have a good team ethic. But who's standing out, especially this season, as far as you're concerned?
I mean, it sounds like a bad answer. It's hard to choose because every week somebody else excels. I mean, there's a couple of iconic players. Matt Reid will be remembered by everybody because he's a big, bustling centre forward. He's integral to the way we play. Alex Woodyard in the middle of the park, really, really industrious, works really hard, does a lot of the dirty jobs, and you know, I like that type of footballer that plays at 100% every single game, but quite often isn't amongst the goals or the assists. And at the back, I think Luke Waterfall is our captain. A year ago, he was sat on the bench watching us lose 4-1 to Dover, not knowing when he was going to play his football. 365 days later, he's leading the team out against the Emirates. So, three possibly stand out, but I don't want to do a disservice to anyone because there's not a bad player amongst them.
Well, I mean, this is where the manager deserves credit, Danny Cowley, who's, you know, it's a funny league, the league that you're in, and that, you know, they're all good players, and I think that this is something that gets overlooked, is that there's the standard of the top six, maybe even top eight, in the National League is, you know, it's probably comparable to League Two, and it wouldn't surprise you if, you know, if Lincoln go up this season, if they maintain the momentum. It's something that you see, for instance, when sides go from League Two into League One, it seems to happen a fair bit of the time. So it's worth pointing out that, you know, these players, as much as they're non-league players, they're not mugs, but that also therefore is why the manager deserves massive credit for getting them together and getting them playing the way in which they are.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, they're quite rightly not mugs. I mean, a lot of people who sit around me at Sinsel Bank have said it's the best Lincoln team they've ever seen, and that's going back past Graham Taylor's side, going past players like John Fashanu and Mick Harford who played for City. This is the best squad I've seen in my lifetime in 30-odd years of supporting Lincoln. It's an incredibly competitive league. I would argue that the top three or four, certainly us, Tranmere and Forest Green, would hold their own in League One as it stands at the moment. You know, we matched Oldham in the FA Cup. I know it was a one-off game. I've no doubt whatsoever that if we were in League One, we would avoid relegation.
I think it's something that I think just gets overlooked, that level. And I think, you know, you can see bad games at any level. And I think that a lot of people, when they go and see a non-league game, they can be a bit unfortunate as to what they see, because, you know, if anything, you can make the argument you're more likely to perhaps see a bad game, perhaps see a one-sided game. But you've mentioned Tranmere there, and I know, for instance, Tranmere supporters at the minute who are excited about this Tranmere team, that, you know, they would probably argue that this Tranmere team will beat the Tranmere team that got relegated from League One, like you say. And, you know, these are really, really good players, and that there's also budget being spent. There's sides focusing on what they're doing down there. It isn't just a mishmash of players. There's proper strategies in place, for instance, Forest Green as well.
Yeah, there is, and it's I think it's shown recently. I mean, we signed Luke Angle this week. he's a player that's dropped down from the Championship to the National League. Now, if it was a league just of has-beens and, you know, rough centre-forwards kicking you all over the place, these players wouldn't want to play in it. But players like Luke Angle, players like Theo Robinson, who have got league pedigree, are more than willing to drop down because footballers know that the National League is no longer that barren wasteland that it used to be maybe 20 or 30 years ago. It is arguably the most competitive league in this country, you know, with one automatic promotion space and so many good teams, so many well-funded teams. You've got teams coming up, such as AFC Fylde come up next year, who, you know, got crowds of 2,000-3,000, bigger than League Two sides. Football's thriving at this level, thriving.
Well, no, and this is something I noticed when I was obviously researching for this and researching for the last time we spoke was, you know, you go on Lincoln's Wikipedia page and it's something as basic as that throws open that there's a youth academy manager, there's a sports scientist, there's a lead sports scientist, an assistant, a sports therapist, two statisticians and a performance analyst. And that is, you know, it's so far away from even from the impression that people have that it's basically lads carrying buckets and sponges, you know, when there's that level of prep going into what Lincoln are doing. And don't get me wrong, you know, the side that you're coming up against this weekend will have, you know, 10 people competing in each of the positions that I've just mentioned, no doubt about that. But it shows the distance that the game's gone when, for instance, 20, 30, 40 years ago, those positions won't even have been in the case for in position for the top flight clubs.
Yeah, absolutely. Lord, we're not all pie-eating goalkeepers that sleep at the ground and mow the lawn. You're quite right. I mean, we've got a great academy. Got great people around the academy. As you say, we've got sports scientists, we've got a nutritionist, I think. The statisticians, they're voluntary and they're putting their time in for nothing. They're trialing a new software program that they're hoping to run by a lot of football league clubs. And certainly Lincoln's success will help promote that. That is more Danny and Nicky's input than anything. Although we've always been a professional football club and we've always been set up as such, the level that it's gone to this season in particular has really excelled. They've put in a couple of the nutritionists, the sports scientists. There's a lot of focus on recovery times. There's a lot of focus on fitness levels. Everything's planned to the nth degree. And you could argue that some of their planning is Championship standard, and that's being reflected in our results and our performances.
I want to flip this question before we get properly stuck into Saturday's game. Would you fancy it if it was at Sinsel Bank?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, my missus, she never talks about football, asked me this while I was driving home from work today. And if it was at Sinsel Bank and they brought the same team that they brought, that they took to Sutton United, I'd fancy it for at least a draw. I really would. I think in terms of organisation and preparation, we'll be spot on. If it was at Sinsel Bank, I'd fancy it.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that you take, you know, the idea of the advantage of playing at home, the tight stadium, all of that sort of stuff. It is going to be different and it is going to be difficult at the Emirates. I'd rule nothing out currently in football for a variety of reasons. I think, you know, you can't. Barcelona have suggested it at one level and you can go right the way down the divisions. The very fact that York held you a few weeks back, if you know what I mean, when they're having an absolutely abject season and yet they could still knock you out of the FA Trophy if lads get completions and all of that. So, you know, you can't rule anything in or out in football, but it is a shame that the balls didn't come out the other way around.
It is to a degree, and it also it isn't. You know, from a fan's perspective, it will be the biggest crowd that I think Lincoln have ever played in front of. Certainly be the biggest ground. Some of the players that you would hope might be on display are world-class, that some of our lads would never even dream of yeah. lining up against. You know, they don't even play with them on FIFA.
Yeah.
It would have been nice to have had them at Sinsel Bank. There's a train of thought that this is our cup final, and the serious business for us is the National League and the potential Wembley appearance in the FA Trophy. That's not to say that they won't be going out and giving it their all, but there won't be a single Lincoln fan who will be shedding a tear if we go there and get beat. As long as we keep our dignity, I think that's important.
Is there a way home for Lincoln in terms of let's not talk necessarily about getting a win, but let's talk about sort of let's almost plot a route to 0-0 or 1-1 on 60. Is that something that you feel is viable? A strategy? Is it beyond just sitting in, or is it the idea that listen, it's going to be a lot of attack versus defence? It's about being organised.
No, I think there's an absolute strategy. I don't think you'll see, I mean, I think when Plymouth possibly came to Anfield earlier in the season, I might be wrong, it was 10 men on the goal line, yeah, and, you know, kick it at us until 90 minutes are up. You'll not get that from Lincoln. Danny and Nicky will be going out to win that game of football. They'll go 4-4-2, I believe, which for a non-league club going to a Premier League club would sound ludicrous. They'll take the game in 15-minute chunks. They'll try and not concede for the first 15 minutes. They'll hit Arsenal with a tempo. They'll think that Arsenal are going to come out as an attackers. They won't be expecting us to go at them. And I certainly think that will happen in the first 15. There'll be no gaps at the back. Everybody will be pressing really hard. It's not just a case of going and shutting up shop. It's 1,000-to-1 chance, Danny says, but he'll prepare for that one chance in 1,000. And I have every confidence that we will do ourselves proud, irrespective of the result.
The next part of this becomes completing the job, which is the season, which would be hopefully getting to Wembley, winning some silverware, winning the league, and then coming up with money to spend, really. You know, the idea of the gate receipts from this, the television money from this, for the entire cup run, you know, should stand Lincoln in very, very good stead, looking at next season, looking at League Two, looking to bounce all the way into League One. Is that going to be the dynamic the football club's looking to make?
Yeah, it is. I think the people running our club now are very grounded. They're very sensible. There's been obviously an influx of money, and that hasn't been frittered away. You know, that's been put to one side. There's been a little bit of investment here and there, but nothing serious. You know, the main aim is to get out of this league, and there isn't a Lincoln City fan anywhere within a 100-mile radius of here that would take a win over Arsenal and then for us to be in this league next season. Absolute priority. An appearance at Wembley will cap off nicely, and just to say that we've been to the Emirates, we're not going to make up the numbers, but from a fan's perspective, it's what it brings, it's the money it brings. And like you've said, the aim has got to be not only to get out of this league, but also to use it as a basis to maybe become another Yeovil, to maybe get ourselves up into the upper reaches of League One. Maybe, you never know, you know, a yo-yo season in the Championship. Investment has come in from Clive Nates, he's a South African businessman that started all this off. The money is, I think, will make somewhere in the region of 2.5 to 3 million from the cup run and the different sponsorship deals that we've got. So it's far, far more than a day out in London for us. I mean, this is, you know, it's going to cap off a cup run that will change our club's history.
Fantastic. I'll ask you for a prediction.
you know, I'm going to go, I'm going to go 4-0 Arsenal.
4-0 Arsenal. Can I ask you for a half-time prediction?
I think 0-0. I think they'll bring on a couple of the big guns in the second half. We won't particularly tire, but when you've got the likes of potentially Sanchez and Ertzl to come on against National League players, it doesn't matter how well-drilled they are. And with it being at the Emirates as well. But I think we'll hold them. I think we'll hold them till 0-0 at half-time.
OK, fantastic to hear from Gary Hutchison from the Stacey West blog. You can find all that stuff on there at Stacey West on Twitter. And the blog, it'll get you the full blog address, actually, as I've just got it right here. Where's it gone? I had it a second ago. Let's not worry about that. We'll give it all the pushes on the Twitter and all that sort of stuff from 50-50 Football. Let's get back in there and see what everyone else thinks. Great to speak to both Natasha and Gary. The remaining sixth round games, then Spurs, Middlesbrough and Chelsea, Manchester United. Do Chelsea, Manchester United there briefly, because it is Monday night. It feels a world away at the moment, but Morbid is absolutely fascinating. The thing for me is the no Ibrahimovic thing. I think this is I think this is going to tell us a lot about United, really, because I think there's interesting conversations around Ibrahimovic in that he's scoring the bulk of United's goals, but you do feel as though he dictates they have to play a certain way, and he quite literally slows them down.
They need a succession plan as well, especially if he's going to be continuing to have countries from around the world throwing their GDPs at him to try and get him to come over. I think, personally, the most interesting thing about this is Mourinho. Normally, I hate focusing on him because he's just like a vortex of negativity. But I think this is going to be one of those games where he tries something a little different. I think there's so much to gain for him from beating Chelsea and knocking them out, because he was embarrassed at Stamford Bridge earlier in the season, and he doesn't get embarrassed very often. His players are embarrassing him every week, the ex-Chelsea players, by playing so well after playing so poorly for him. So I wouldn't be surprised if he uses the absence of Ibrahimovic to go something a little bit different, maybe a return of the lesser spotted 4-4-2, because one of the things I think Chelsea could be potentially vulnerable to is two up front. against their three, and not very many people have tried it. And they have the players to do it. I mean, they've got Martial, they've got Rooney still. They could even have Mkhitaryan and Rashford, of course.
Rashford matter.
So they've got the players to do it. I mean, you could look at a 4-3-1-2, keeping the three midfielders in check, having Mkhitaryan in front, and then two of the other three up front. I really think that this is the kind of game where Mourinho wants to say, look, this is why I'm the man still.
That's what I think this may be one of those games, Rob, where there's every chance you come out the other side feeling as though Mourinho has done a job that he can do. A reminder that he is a fantastic football manager, a great tactician. There's every chance he does actually find a way home through this. The only thing I'd say is that, you know, I've noticed it whenever I've seen United this season, the League Cup final as an example, is that whilst I think that in one sense Ibrahimovic, I think, is slowing United down, on the other, the extent to which he's alpha mailing the life out of the dressing room and the team and is put in that position by Mourinho is huge. You know, he will be amiss simply because he's been turned into such a totem, that to not have the totem means he becomes amiss.
Yes, he does. There's the psychological impact on the team of all the drama around the ban and what happened last week as well. I think we can underestimate how that can unhinge, because they sense the players' frustration and anger. And as you said, he's a totemic figure. I think it's a very interesting clash. I'm not saying Conte and Mourinho are the
made
same.
Made up it on Monday night, you know.
Oh, sorry?
Made up it on Monday night.
Yes, what a Monday.
It feels like something to really look forward to.
Yes, exactly. It's a real excuse to get down the booze on Monday night. It feels like a sort of meeting of minds. And it's not like Chris Eubank fighting Chris Eubank almost. I think they'll stand off each other. I think they'll stand and go. They will urge each other to throw the first punch. I think that's the way this will be played out. Watching Chelsea look closely recently, I thought they're very, very adept at letting the opposition have the ball in the way that they want. This is a Conte thing. This is why we think Chelsea are winning without playing that well. It's because they're quite happy to not be the team on the front foot for the first half hour in many, many games. That West Ham, their West Ham win the other night was just quintessential Chelsea this season. West Ham are playing okay for half an hour. They're broadly on top of them and a little bit unlucky not to have a goal. And Chelsea arguably score against the run of play. But they allow West Ham onto them, they absorb them, and they just hit them with an incredible counter. Conte's all about the counter. Mourinho, as I said, I think they'll both sit off. It wouldn't be a smart guess to say this might be a draw and he'll take them back to Old Trafford. But you can see somebody getting the 1-0. You can see Mourinho getting the 1-0, but I wouldn't bet on it. I'd say the draw is the safer option.
I think both of them, well, Man United in particular, will be so keen to avoid a draw that you might start seeing a kitchen sink of 20 minutes to go if it's a draw, and then it becomes a really...
Yeah, they don't want that. They don't want that extra game, do they?
No, and again, this is going to be a big game for the referee, I think. I think with so many games hinging on big decisions, especially at this time of the season, I don't know who is reffing the game, but they're going to need to be very strong because they're going to try it on. Both teams are very good at doing all that narky, snarky stuff, and I really hope it doesn't turn into one of those games.
I sort of hope it does.
It feels like a good game for the competition. I know we endlessly talk about the credibility of the FA Cup and how it'd be nice to see it what it once was.
Doesn't get bigger than this as a quarterfinal.
Yeah, I was going to say it. And the fact that it's nicely isolated on the Monday night, the fact that it's Mourinho against his old club, it's tabletop.
It's contained on the Monday night.
It can cut loose.
I want 14-man brawls.
All the ingredients are there for our classic cup tie.
I want eyes poked. That's what I want.
Blood, thunder.
Yes, I want both blood and thunder, ideally. And I'm happy for it to slow burn. I quite like a slow burn, blood and thunder. Not much happens for an hour, and then there's half an hour of absolutely blamming lumps out of each other.
This is one of those where you sort of realise why FA Cup replays are still a wonderfully unique, good English thing. Because we get to the end and we go, oh, good, they're going to do it again. It's kind of a threat.
Yeah, becomes all the aggro that's built up gets to kind of have another go.
Becomes a throwback to those 80s Cup semi-finals of Liverpool involved in quite a few, which seem to go on forever. Titanic struggles, yeah. Bring it.
Against your own sense of humanity. Last one's Millwall, Spurs, Millwall. And I'm not going to focus much on Millwall in this one, not for any contentious reason, just more because Tottenham need a trophy this season, I think. I think that in the way in which there's a couple of sides knocking around, and it's easy to say Liverpool were one of them as well, it's a separate conversation, but Tottenham this season could very much do with getting a trophy. They don't know if they're going to win the Football League. They're out of the Europa League. Obviously, they don't win the League Cup. So they're now in a situation where the one that the they can win is the FA Cup. And you feel as though the achievements, not just of this season, but last season, need to be crowned by something. That's why I think it's a slightly different situation to Liverpool and even Arsenal, is that they need the positivity that's built up around the club needs the bauble. It needs that this is what you got for it, lads.
The Pochettino era needs a platform for liftoff, basically. Something from which to say, okay, this is what we've achieved so far. This is where we need to get to. For Spurs always feel like they need a trophy, to be honest. It's been, what, 10 years since their last one, I think, the League Cup.
There's that mad Ramos League Cup, yeah.
Yeah.
Where they won the League Cup and then didn't win a game for the rest of the season. Yeah. For what felt like the next 3 years or something.
And I think a lot of the time when you see the way that, I mean, Spurs fans, I mean, I've got a few in my family, and one of the things, they do tend to kind of judge themselves within the reflection of Arsenal. And with Arsenal going through such a bad point, I think it would be such an extra fillip for Spurs to be able to put that trophy on the sideboard.
Put the trophy on the sideboard and finish ahead of them.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you gave them the choice of which one, I still think Spurs fans would go for the trophy. I genuinely do, because I think it's something that a day out that you get to have, you get to kind of remember it for all ever. I mean, reality, they will have a fun day if they finish above them, but it will be a day.
I think this is the importance of the domestic cups in the modern age. For the teams, the likes of the Liverpools and Spurs and Arsenals, who face, in many, many cases, insurmountable odds to finish ahead of the money of United, Chelsea and City, that if they have a respectable season where they finish third, maybe a second or fourth or whatever, but a respectable league season's worth, but it never really has a, what's the word? It never has a point.
It never sort of consummates.
Yes, exactly. There's no orgasmic moment for the season. And the cup is sort of like, almost like a parallel thing. As you said, it's more than the day out. It's that chance to celebrate who they are and go, look, we've had this great season and this is what we've earned, this sideshow, this festival of us. And I think that's why, as much as anything, as much as it being on the record as a trophy, I think it's about that.
Okay. Quick predictions then. Chelsea United and Spurs versus Millwall. Roberto?
I said it's a draw, Chelsea United, so it's a 1-1 for me.
And what about Spurs-Millwall?
3-1 to Spurs.
I think 2-1 Spurs. I also think it's going to be Spurs-Arsenal in the FA Cup final, by the way. Just throwing that out there. Chelsea-Man United, 1-0 Man United.
1-0 Man United. Okay.
Wouldn't it be a thing? Wenger, Spurs-Man U, Wenger announces, not Man U, Spurs-Arsenal final. Wenger decides that week to announce he's leaving and wins it. And can go with his head held. I'd take that for football's history, for fairy stories, for love of the game.
I genuinely believe that he has earned himself a little bit of a fairy tale ending, because so far it's all been pretty sour in his last 2 years.
The romanticism of Gutman and Stewart. Thank you, everyone. Thank them very much indeed for joining
us
today. It's lovely. It's lovely. Thank them very much indeed for coming with us today. And thank you very much to Gary, to Natasha, to Dan and to Andy. Thanks to them indeed. This has been 50-50 Football. It has been your Thursday equivalent, looking ahead to the entirety of the weekend. Tell your mates we need you to talk about this sort of stuff. But as ever, it's been a real pleasure.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.